One of Vladimir Putin's closest allies visits Beijing this week. Is China moving closer to providing military aid to Russia?
I think the consequences would indeed be profound, and I think the world would change, and China would be, to a large degree, relegated to a kind of pariah status by most of the world.
Plus, heading into year two of the conflict, frozen exports of Ukrainian grain continue to impact a growing global hunger crisis.
We've seen a sharp rise of people being food insecure, and we still expect the situation to be worsening in 2023.
And later in the program, a Grammy-winning country singer teams up with Ukraine's leader for a song of solidarity. Today is Monday, February 27th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. China on Monday accused the U.S. of outright bullying and double standards in leveling what it called illegal sanctions on Chinese companies as part of U.S. actions against Russia's Wagner Group and others. Now, the entities were targeted for their role in the war in Ukraine and mercenary activities, including human rights abuses. This, as Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko, a close ally to Vladimir Putin, will visit Beijing this week as U.S. concerns grow that China is considering providing military aid to Russia. I talked about those concerns with David Feierstein, CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. Over the weekend, CIA Director William Burns repeated the earlier statement by Secretary of State Antony Blinken that there's pretty high confidence that Chinese leadership is considering sending lethal aid to Russia. I know there are a lot of concerns about it. How likely do you think it is that China will make the move?
Well, it seems unlikely to me for a variety of reasons. I think it would be a major departure from China's traditional positioning on these types of issues, a kind of a positioning of neutrality, of abstention in the United Nations votes, and of not, you know, jumping in forcefully on either side of these types of conflicts. You know, China has generally been most comfortable staking out kind of neutral positions that don't offend anyone to too great a degree. And if China were to go down the road of actually supplying lethal aid to Russia in its assault against Ukraine, it would be surprising to me. I would find it hard to believe that China would regard the provision of lethal aid to Russia as being in China's interests. I think China would think very carefully before going down that road. While it may be considering that possibility, according to U.S. intelligence and the U.S. government, I would be surprised if it goes down that road. I think the costs would be immense, and I think China understands that.
You mentioned that China has taken a neutral stance in the war, but it's also said that it has no limits on its friendship with Russia. And of course, they've rolled out this potential peace plan. Do you see China as a viable peace broker in the conflict?
I don't. You know, I understand that the 12-point plan is out there, and, you know, on its face, a lot of it seems, you know, reasonable and moderate. But I think China's very close relationship with Russia and its framing of the entire conflict as something that essentially was started by the West, started by NATO, and so forth, I think that probably disqualifies China from being able to serve and be seen as serving as an effective and neutral mediator in any type of peace process around the Russia-Ukraine issue. Certainly, Ukraine would have serious problems with some of the points in that plan and some of China's positioning on the issue, where China, while stating that it is neutral, in reality, you know, tilts toward Russia in some important ways, including, you know, China's embrace of Russia's narrative about how this conflict started. I think it would cast into serious doubt China's ability to serve effectively as a mediator between Russia and Ukraine. I think the sentiment, which is, you know, that China has articulated of, hey, let's try to get this resolved peacefully, is obviously a sentiment that anyone could be supportive of. But as has been noted, the way to end this peacefully is for Russia to simply stop its assault, its unprovoked and unjustified assault on Ukraine. And if it were to withdraw its troops and get back to the status quo ante, then you'd have a situation where there could be discussions about how to maintain peace. But I can't imagine any scenario in which the leadership of Ukraine and the world would accept peace discussions that aren't predicated on getting back to Ukrainian control of its territory. And China does not, you know, has not explicitly condemned Russia for this aggression against Ukraine. And I think that makes China kind of a non-starter when it comes to mediating the conflict.
If China were to move ahead with providing Russia with lethal aid, what would that mean for the U.S.-China relationship?
I think it would be a major turning point in the relationship because it would place China into basically a proxy military conflict with the United States for the first time since the Vietnam War. So for nearly 50 years, whatever disagreements the United States and China have had with each other, and obviously we've had some very profound disagreements on a wide range of issues, we haven't been on opposite sides of a physical lethal proxy war. But if China were to start sending lethal material to Russia, then we would now be backing two different sides in a war that is killing people. I think it would have major impacts on a variety of areas within the relationship, including the trade relationship, political relationship, U.S. public sentiment toward China. It would affect U.S. sentiment, including in Congress and in Washington, as to the provision of sensitive technologies to China, Chinese investment in the United States. And frankly, I think it would color U.S. thinking with respect to U.S. approach to Taiwan. I think the whole game would change if China were to do that. And I would make one other point, and that is that two-way trade between China and Russia is about $185 billion in 2022, but two-way trade between China and the United States and the European Union and other Western allies is something more like $1.5, $1.6 trillion. So it's a 10-to-1 ratio. And it just seems very difficult for me to imagine that China would find it in its interests to jeopardize that level of economic and trade activity while siding with a country that is violating egregiously China's own stated principles of respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity. But if it should go down that road, I think the consequences would indeed be profound. And I think the world would change and China would be to a large degree relegated to a kind of pariah status by most of the world.
That was David Feierstein, CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. At least for now, the United States is declining to send fighter jets to Ukraine. But as VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias reports, there are some legislators in Congress pushing the Biden administration to change its mind.
With Soviet-era Grad rockets, Ukrainian soldiers continued their efforts over the weekend to recover territory lost to the Russian army in Kharkiv. While Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky praised a new round of sanctions announced Saturday by the European Union against Moscow, he also appealed for more international support.
We are capable of putting an end to the Russian aggression this year.
The possibility of the Ukrainians boosting their defense systems with US F-16 jets and long-range artillery is not currently being contemplated, said US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on ABC's This Week.
In this phase, the critical element is ground maneuver capability, and that means tanks, armored personnel carriers, infantry fighting vehicles, and the F-16 question is a question for later.
Some legislators, however, aim to do more now. Republican Representative Michael McCaul told ABC.
We can certainly write into our appropriations bills prioritizing weapon systems. We intend to do that. Well, I think with enough pressure from Congress on both sides of the aisle, we can get into Ukraine what they really need to win this fight.
But the U.S. can't do it alone, and the Biden administration will need European allies to step up their contributions, Republican Senator Dan Sullivan stressed on NBC's Meet the Press.
They've had a commitment to spend at a minimum, and it should be a floor, not a ceiling, 2% of their GDP on defense. The vast majority of the NATO allies that we have don't do that.
On the diplomatic front, French President Emmanuel Macron announced he'll visit China in April to discuss Beijing's peace brokering efforts. The United States also wants to keep the lines of communication open, said National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on NBC. But no high-level talks are planned between President Joe Biden and his counterpart, Xi Jinping.
Nothing scheduled at the moment, though I anticipate the two leaders will speak at some point in the not-too-distant future.
He emphasized that military communication channels with China are necessary to avoid escalation, surprises, and mistakes. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
The Ukrainian military says Russia has launched attacks with exploding drones on several regions of the country overnight from Sunday into this morning. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Ukraine's general staff says its forces have shot down 11 out of 14 Iranian-made Shahed drones, the Kyiv Regional Administration adding that 9 Shaheds were downed overnight around the capital. Meanwhile, Ukraine's presidential office says that at least 2 civilians have been killed and 9 others wounded by Russian attacks during the past 24 hours. Intense fighting has continued around Bakhmut, Avdiivka and Volodar in Donetsk, where Ukrainian towns face relentless Russian shelling. Ukraine's governor there, Pavlo Krylenko, says Russia has actively used aircraft and heavy artillery to strike peaceful cities. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The head of the United Nations says Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine has triggered, quote, the most massive violations of human rights in the world today. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said in a speech in Geneva today that the invasion has unleashed widespread death, destruction, and displacement. Guterres also said attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure have caused many casualties and terrible suffering. The intense fighting for territory in eastern Ukraine was in sharp focus on Sunday at a Ukrainian field hospital treating wounded from the intense battle for the city of Bakhmut, which has been devastated. A constant flow of battered and exhausted soldiers came in on stretchers. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. Russian narratives calling the invasion of Ukraine a, quote, special military operation are being heard in some countries thanks to a Russian disinformation campaign targeting specific areas of the world. VOA's Virginia Gunawan reports.
Much has been written about Russian disinformation campaigns in the United States and the European Union. But analysts say Western countries are not the only targets of Russian attempts to sway public opinion. Radityo Dharmaputra is an expert on Russia policy in Asia at Indonesia's Erlangga University.
Instead of targeting the West, like usual, they target these countries in the global south to African countries, Southeast Asia, Latin America. It's changing direction.
Russia Today, or RT, is the best-known Russian state-controlled media outlet. After Russia invaded Ukraine, the EU and Canada banned the organization. The U.S. did not ban RT, but major American cable companies dropped it. Russia Beyond the Headlines is a lesser-known government-funded media platform. More subtle in its persuasion than RT, it focuses on Russian culture and identity and is presented to audiences in their own language. For predominantly Muslim Indonesia, Islam features heavily.
So for several years already, the way Russia uses its media is trying to portray Russia as this friends of Islam.
Russia's media efforts in Indonesia intensify in 2015, following its military intervention in Syria's civil war, which created a strong backlash. Its charm offensive has continued into the Ukraine conflict.
And just when the war started, I think they realized that, oh, this is actually working, because that's the main message in Indonesian social media in the very beginning, not about the West, not about Ukraine. It is about Russia is quite friendly towards Islam.
Security experts note that the playbook used in Indonesia is also used elsewhere in Asia, as well as in Africa and Latin America. Kyle Walter is head of research and insight at Logically, a company that works to combat mis- and disinformation.
What they do in places like Africa and places like Southeast Asia as well, they focus on the West colonial history and use that as a way to position Russia as a strategic partner looking forward.
According to the media literacy organization Debunk.org, the Russian government allocated $1.5 billion to fund the media platforms it controls in 2021. That amount tripled from January to March 2022 compared to the same period the previous year. Virginia Gunawan, VOA News, Washington.
And on the subject of truth in messaging and information, I caught up with Jeremy Deer, Deputy General Secretary for the International Federation of Journalists, which represents more than 600,000 media workers across the world, and which has suspended the Russian Union of Journalists over its actions since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So the International Federation of Journalists has decided to suspend, effective immediately, the Russian journalist or Union of Journalists over its actions since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Tell us why this world body made this major decision.
It was a decision made as a result of numerous actions, but most especially the decision by the Russian Union of Journalists to establish four new branches of their union in the Ukrainian territories that were annexed by the Russian government. And this stepped over a line for us where many of our unions are often involved in situations of war or conflict or regional disputes, but we expect that they will maintain professional solidarity so that they will help any journalist who is in trouble, that they will not take the political position of their governments, but that they will remain independent and professional. And by establishing these four branches and calling them branches of Russian territory, it was felt that the Russian Union of Journalists had crossed that line and had clearly taken a position in support of the invasion of Ukraine, and that was simply unacceptable for our executive.
The head of Russia's journalist union told state media in Russia, though, that this violates the IFJ's charter. Is that, how do you respond to that?
I'm sure he would say that, but we're quite clear that we've acted according to the rules of the Federation, that there was a complaint that they no longer met the criteria for being members, that that complaint was investigated by the General Secretary, and that more than two-thirds of the executive committee supported a decision to suspend the union. Under our rules, that union have a right to appeal to our global Congress to reverse that decision, but that doesn't take place until 2026. In the meantime, they are suspended. But I don't think there is any way that they can say that they have stuck to our rules, that they have upheld our principles and our values of media freedom since the invasion started.
Other European journalist unions also threatened to quit the global body over this activity. Did that factor into this? And do you think this is likely permanent?
Well, we hope that it is not permanent. I mean, we understand that there are very strong feelings about the participation of the Russian Union in the Federation. And that's why when there was a complaint, there was an investigation done and a decision taken. The complaint they have is that that decision wasn't taken quickly enough. But we are very clear that the rules need to apply to every member, no matter how bad we think they might have behaved, and that required a proper investigation and then a decision. So maybe it took longer than some people wanted it to, but in the end, the decision made is one that commands universal support.
International Federation of Journalists Deputy General Secretary Jeremy Deer, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this.
Thanks.
As the Russian invasion of Ukraine now enters its second year, humanitarian groups working to stave off acute hunger in Africa say they've faced big funding shortfalls, partly because those funds have been diverted to Ukraine. Tom Per Kosta, spokesperson for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Central and West Africa, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam many countries on the continent continue to feel a direct impact since Ukrainian shipments of grain and fertilizer were cut off by the Russians.
It's important to remember that most of African countries, especially in West and Central Africa, and many of them, in addition, endure a crisis. Most of the food comes from farming and harvesting. And this has been impacted heavily when the prices of cereals and fertilizers went up. And we've seen a sharp rise of people being food insecure. And we still expect the situation to be worsening in 2023. Just to give you an example, by the period of the lean season, which should be between May and August, we accept 48 million people to be food insecure in Mali, Burkina Faso, Central African Republic, and Nigeria. And this is partly due to the war in Ukraine.
The food insecurity that we're hearing about, you know, Somalia and the countries you mentioned, it's supposed to be the worst in decades. Is there a direct correlation, would you say, between the war in Ukraine and what's happening in Africa with food insecurity?
I would say it exacerbates. It's not the only reason. Obviously, the main reasons are widespread conflicts, climate change, but of course, the war in Ukraine is worsening the situation. And it's also worsening our ability as humanitarians to support people who are food insecure. Just to give you a concrete example, in the Central African Republic this year, due to a big shortage of fuel, we had to suspend our operations in some part of Central African Republic, which affected 3.1 million people, basically. 3.1 million people were already suffering in a critical situation, and we could not reach part of them due to a critical lack of fuel. What's striking is that years after years, we say this is the worst year in the region in terms of food insecurity, but everywhere it's getting worse. So we don't know when it's going to end, really, because every year we have additional burdens on the region, and you have to add to that the fact that this region is heavily neglected. The West and Central African region especially is really neglected by the international community compared to other regions in crisis.
When you say compared to other regions in crisis, are you referring to Ukraine?
Yeah, especially Ukraine. We have seen immediate support of the international community for Ukraine, which is great. We have seen the full mobilization of EU countries, the US and others. They have really poured funding for the humanitarian crisis and for the rest. And we are not seeing that in our region. Just to give you some figures, in 2022, Ukraine has received 80% of the money needed to cover the full humanitarian crisis. But the Democratic Republic of Congo has received less than 50%.
Tom Harkasta with the Norwegian Refugee Council speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam. And last but not least today, a year ago, country star Brad Paisley watched the news as Russian troops invaded Ukraine. And like many people around the world, he felt helpless at the images of people fleeing their homes. Timed with the one-year anniversary of the war's start, Paisley has now released a new song featuring Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking proudly about his country and people. Associated Press reporter Ed Donahue has the story.
The song is called Same Here.
Got a friend across the ocean. Seems like a million miles away.
Paisley tells the AP as Russian troops invaded Ukraine, he felt helpless at the images of people being forced from their homes.
You can put us in different places with different flags and different languages, but we have so many similarities.
Praise for peace and freedom. Same here.
He doesn't sing, but Zelensky is part of the song.
What's same here in Ukrainian?
Так само. We speak different languages in our life. Yes, but I think we appreciate same things.
Paisley says President Zelensky understands art is how you reach the most people.
It's a lot easier to hear something with a melody.
I'm Ed Donahue.
And that'll do it for us today. But stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.